doing?
Adderall, it always sounds like a drug to me, like a,
you know, seen
like
this?
Yeah, I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of times people, I bring them and they go, I got the same one.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, he's just a stone's throw from here to Shapeshifter, right? That's right?
Yeah.
Over here.
Yeah.
Close.
Yeah.
Just 4th Avenue.
But yeah, between 3rd and 4th. Yeah, it's right. And right. Yeah, exactly. It's this block.
Yep. Basically. Yep. So. Yeah, I've been spending time over there. Doing. I do blindfold tests there. Those guys are great, you know, so I've been doing blindfold tests.
Cool.
Okay. Well, here we go. Again, yeah, speaking of your father, condolences. I know it's been a couple months, right? Month.
Yeah.
A month?
Yeah,
month
it's plus? February, yeah, so a month and a half maybe.
Uh-huh.
6 weeks. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And you did the right thing by unplugging your show at Birdland and redoing it. I mean, you were going to play in February, the week of the release, right? At
yeah,
Birdland?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, he went into the, it was, he went into the hospital. I took him to the emergency room about a little less than a week before the concert, and that week was a very abrupt decline for him, and so I...
What did he have?
He had lung cancer and pneumonia.
Oh my God.
And we didn't know until December. Well, actually, we didn't even know that. We didn't even know until January. We didn't even. The big symptoms really cropped up and came to my attention in December. We figured it out in January. Yeah, it was fast. Yeah.
You know, he's a really important person in your life. I've read all about it.
That's true,
dedicate the new album to him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way this happened was all very unexpected, you know, in the suddenness of it. But I did have a sense that this was going to be the last recording that he would, you know, that he would be around for. And
Did he listen to it?
He had been not listening to music as much in the last few months, and his speakers were not so good lately, but he ordered a pair of headphones and sat there and listened to it, and he really did love the recording, he was very, very involved in the music and took a lot of pride and interest in my recordings and my performances and stuff. So it was,
Obviously, this is your third road, your third recording. Mm-hmm. Did he put any input into while you were recording? Like, oh God, it would be great if you put some more Hornet in there or something. Or, you know, did he give you any...
I think he had that inclination. He was prone to that kind of thing. I feel like for this recording, he was just. I think he knew I was on a certain mission and a path with this, and I knew I had my program that I was working on. So he was like very supportive of it in that way. Like he was excited for it, couldn't wait to hear it and all that. But I didn't feel that, you know. Actually, he was a person who always had strong opinions and would always, you know. In fact, he's come to gigs, and at every gig he had something to say. This drummer's too loud. This bass player, you know, isn't fitting in, or you know, I like that horn player better. But he knew I had my vision, and we talked about it, we shared it, but I did my own plan with it. You know,
yeah.
So.
That's a nice way to send him up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He was like that with his own work too. He was that way with his own work. He had his own vision of the work that he did in his life, his writing and his his teaching and thinking that he did. And so, you know, I think we were in very different fields. He just happened to be a music fanatic, but he knew that I, you know, as an artist and jazz musician, I owned my own vision and my own work. So.
Well, you started off on guitar, right? And then gravitated to piano?
Well, actually, my parents started me on classical piano, and I gravitated towards guitar and especially blues, and then found my way. That became the music that I was finding from. That was my intro into my own, not music that I was made to do, but music that I was, you know, pursuing myself. And from there, I worked my way back to piano and jazz. Yeah. So it was a process. Yeah, it took quite a few years. Yeah.
And your dad would take you to all kinds of different shows too, right? Like, genre-wise.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I did and still do have a wide range of musical interests and loves, and you know, even within jazz, I'm you know, I love Gene Harris. I love Sonny Stitt. And I love Coltrane. I love, you know, I love Kenny Kirkland. I love Herbie Hancock. So there's Keith Jarrett. So there's quite a range. But beyond that, yeah, it was, you know, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Sting. And then we were also going to the jazz shows too, without question. Herbie Hancock, Oscar Peterson, whatever Ray Brown, whatever we could. I wanted all of that, and he made sure that I did hear it. Yeah. So.
And
he,
pop shows too, right? Rock shows?
Yeah. I mean.
Like what?
Sting, Eric Clapton. Let's see what else.
It was okay.
Yeah.
And your first album was Thriller. First album you listened to and the first album you bought was by Branford, right?
Let's see, that's right. Yeah, Thriller was the first recording that I decided myself to actually buy. I picked it out and I used to listen to it every day from beginning to end. I was pretty obsessed with that. I mean, my dad had Branford records at the house, so I remember listening to tracks that I, you know, as a young kid and just hearing about jazz, and then, you know, years later, and I would go back and like 20 years later, I'd go back and actually rediscover the music and like actually learn the Kenny Kirkland solo off of the record and stuff. But I'd been hearing it since I was a young kid, so it was interesting. Yeah,
I read someplace that your first jazz record that you bought was Branford's Renaissance.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. That's true.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now I want to talk to you. We'll get a chance to talk about the music soon, but your journey is unusual for, well, you're 44, so you're not a young jazz musician anymore, but still, when you were young, your journey was really different. I mean, you dropped out of Rutgers 2 years in, right? And you'd worked with Kenny, and then you decided to go to Philadelphia, and which doesn't happen. You're so unusual, you can't believe it. Most people gravitate to New York and starve. And so why Philly? I mean, was it an influence of Kenny's, or did you just want to stretch out?
It was somewhat. It was definitely an influence of Kenny. I ran into some other musicians when I was quite young that had kind of graduated from the Philly scene, and so there was, you know, there was they started both through Kenny and some of these other folks. I was directed to specific musicians on the Philadelphia jazz scene that I should go and listen to, and Kenny. So there was a player named, there's a pianist named Eddie Green. There was a saxophonist named Tony Williams, and then there was, of course, Mickey Roker at that time was playing most nights at this club, or at Leeds, and Mickey was playing to me as on the level of any drummer in the world, in New York or anywhere, but all these guys had a special approach to music. It wasn't the New York approach that I was hearing at that time, which was a lot of, you know, I think Brad Meldow was young and coming up, and even the Branford and Kenny Kirkland were big at that time, but the Philly thing was totally different, and it was a soulful thing that connected with a neighborhood community. It wasn't a hipster jazz community. It was like a neighborhood of people that grew up listening to jazz, and there was a soulful connection that was very direct between the musicians and the audience. No one put on airs, let's say. It was just like they were there for the music. They loved it. They clapped. It wasn't. No one was trying to look cool or make a name for themselves. It was a community kind of experience.
And so, what did you learn from that quote unquote university in your own playing?
I mean, I think that's what it is. It's, well, first of all, you have to. It's not about technique. It's not about tricks, and at least not in a. Those aren't the reasons why you're playing. Those are tools. So whatever you study, whatever you might learn from a teacher or a music school, they are only giving you tools. It's a means to an end. But that's not. You're not showing all of your greatest hits and stuff. You have to create a piece of music that people respond to, and you have to be directly involved emotionally in it, at least for my interest. You know, if you don't have that, it's kind of a deal breaker. So they were soulful and swinging and playing their asses off. I mean, without playing a whole lot of fancy stuff, with the simplest of tools and simplest of tunes, they made a huge statement. So that was the lesson. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Okay. Yeah. Well, I admire you for doing that to go a different route.
Right.
Because so many people graduate from Berkeley and they come rushing to New York, and they're kind of like, well, what do we do now?
Yeah.
How do we? Because there's so many jazz musicians in New York who are playing for $30 a night or something.
Right.
You know, it's like. And it seems like that provides a depth, but taking it one step further, when you got to New York, lived in Williamsburg, you headed east to play in kind of like interesting settings there.
Yeah.
Tell me about that and why you did that and what that taught you.
I didn't plan it. I was out every night of the week, meeting players, sitting in, hustling. So you'd sit in, you'd meet other people at jam sessions, and a pianist, a fellow pianist named Sasha Perry, recommended me for a gig in way out in Queens at a serious dive that's called the Village Door, and it's not functioning as a jazz venue anymore, but it had a history. I think a lot of big time players did come through there at one point. So I ended up at this club in Jamaica, Queens, called the Village Door, subbing for this guy. And it was long hours for low pay, but I mean, I just moved to New York and I wanted to play, and they offered me three nights a week there, playing with some experienced players. And there was a kind of a community feeling there, and there was an expectation that you would play play music that wasn't so erudite that you would alienate the neighborhood folks. So it had a similarity. And from there we'd sneak, because there was actually long nights and long breaks, we'd sneak out to other clubs in the neighborhood on the break. And that's how I sat in with Walter Perkins, the great drummer who had a long history and played with everyone from Billie Holiday to Harold Mayburn and Errol Garner and people like that. And he started hiring me in his trio. And then soon I had my own gigs in the neighborhood. I stayed in that scene for a couple of years. I felt like I was learning. I felt like that was where I needed to be. I had to do a lot of things to hustle to survive, because at best you'd make 50 to 75 bucks a night. You know, I didn't keep up. I couldn't keep up with the $30 a night stuff for too long. But like, it wasn't a lot of bread, so it was a struggle. But I felt like I was really getting something out of it, and I'd go to Manhattan, I'd go hear Kenny Barron, but like I didn't think that I had to follow all the latest trends at that time, and I still don't feel that I have to do that. I'll always keep an open mind, but I try not to jump on the bandwagon. I try to follow my own path and my own vision. So
cool.
So that was some of my early music.
Well, like I said, I mean, I admire you to do that. I didn't even know there was a jazz scene out in Queens, in Jamaica, Queens.
So I don't think it's there anymore.
Really?
I don't think these. I shouldn't say that.
Ballpark. What years were those?
I can tell you what years they were. I got to New York in '93, and it's that started right away. So I'd say it was like '93, '94, '95. I think it was I can't remember exactly when it wrapped up and when I moved on from it, but it was a couple years there. Yeah.
And then you came back and went to school. You finished school, a new school, right? And then you went to Sony Purchase, right?
That's right, yeah.
So, dialing back a little bit, what did Kenny Barron teach you? What did he bring to the plate for you?
I mean, so much. He's a soft-spoken person, and he didn't verbally like share that much. Like, I wouldn't say we talked a whole lot in the lessons. Literally, most of the time we were playing together, like duets. There's two pianos. You know, Kenny can sound like an entire band if he wants to. So it was, we just basically would be playing duets the entire time. But he got big on. He was very, very much, so Kenny was on the road a lot, so there wasn't a ton of lessons. I mean, maybe 9-10 lessons in 2 years. He was very much into, I mean, first of all, it was just the feeling that you would hear. This, the feeling that there's a feeling of, the jazz feeling was so complete in his playing. He had that old school feeling. No matter what he played, it always had a great swinging touch and a swinging feel. No matter if it was a modern tune or an old tune, and he was always into it. Every tune was played from a place of the feeling.
And Brazilian too.
Oh,
quite an aficionado, and they love him.
Yeah. He I think he actually thrives on different. Putting himself in different contexts, you know. He early on pushed me to work on ballad playing, and he would sit there and just play. He would sit there and play for, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't play a solo on a ballad. I couldn't play a ballad, and he would sit there and play "Darn That Dream." He'd be like, "Try it like this." and it would just be a masterpiece. And then, you know, the next week he'd say it again, like, okay, let's try this again. And it would be body and soul, and bam, another masterpiece. Like a magnificent solo, you know, a gorgeous, you know, everything was just beautiful. And it took me some years to feel like I could begin to find my, you know, find that as a strength in my playing. It took quite a while. So, it was that Philly, there was something about his history in Philadelphia that I felt like I had, it would push me to go there. I like, because there's this guy, he's ready to show me whatever he can, but he can't show me how to play, how to swing the way he swings. He can't show me how to play with feeling. So I felt like I had to find that on my own, and I went to investigate where he came from and understand the scene that he grew up in, because he'd started playing, you know, when he was 13 years old, and, you know, at clubs with his brother and such. So I tried to do some homework, some field research, so to speak. Yeah.
When you went up to Sony Purchase, what did David bring to the place for you? Hilsey.
Yeah, David was really remarkable. I had known of him and followed him, when I heard that he was going to be starting at Purchase, I made sure that I'd study with him. And he's a complete different. Different approach. I mean, he could sit there and exactly. He can play perfect Art Tatum, you know, or perfect Cedar Walton, perfect, you know, McCoy, Barry Harris. He can play what. He knows their work so well, and he views it as his doesn't know his stuff if he doesn't know their work backwards and forwards and bring that into his own playing. So for me, you know, it was like, okay, no, you have to learn these Cedar Walton solos note for note. I know you like Kenny Kirkland, and that's what you're into right now, and you're transcribing that, but you're gonna have to put that on hold, and you're gonna have to learn this Cedar Walton stuff. And you know, don't fight me on this. You want a master's degree, you got to get this. So it was an amazing experience, because I had transcribed solos, but I had never had to play along with the record note for note in that exact way, and he lit the fire under me and let me know I just didn't have a choice. And it was you know, there's people, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to. So when you care, you have to about something, you have to be willing to fight for it. And he was willing to fight me on that, and I did what he asked, and I got a tremendous amount out of it. So, you know, that's still an ongoing thing. You know, studying solos, McCoy, Herbie, Kenny Kirkland. That's still a part of what I do. It's not I write my own thing. I'm always trying to bring it into my own playing.
Yeah.
And I don't have that philosophy that I have to be able to sound exactly like those people, but I do study them, and so I got a lot out of it. David is a great teacher, and I'm indebted to him. Yeah.
Kenny Kirkland, why did you decide to do your master's on Kenny Kirkland?
Well, I guess since it may have had something to do with that Branford record that I first bought, him being on it, my first jazz record, and my first introduction to my first connection to jazz musicians was Kenny playing in Sting's band.
Kenny play what?
Kenny playing in Sting's band. He's been there on the horizon for me for since the beginning. There's something about so musically he's very important to me. He's the modern. He had that soulful thing, but he also had the language of Chick and Herbie and McCoy and Keith Jarrett. So he was able to bring like the different elements that I'm interested in together. But more, even more than the music, is there's something in particular about his story that I find very, very moving, and it's the way he only had the one solo record. He was in a kind of an age where everyone is all about their own project and trying to be a star. He almost avoided the spotlight. He you know, and he had no interest in really being a band leader. Not really. He just wanted to write his own music and play it. But he just wanted to play and what is it about Kenny? He's yeah, there's something about that. I thought more and more about it. I mean, we know so much about Herbie Hancock. We know so much about McCoy Tyner, but here's this guy that had a very different kind of a career, and he made a huge statement, and it had a big impact. I mean, if you talk to people, you know, certainly in my generation, if you talk to like Robert Glasper, Marcus Strickland, they're going to mention Kenny as an important person in their, you know, in an important influence. I think that's my understanding, and yeah, he's that life that he lived. You know, there wasn't he had his challenges, and he just there was a melancholy quality to his life. The especially the way he died, it was very tragic, and I don't know, I can't ever quite put it out of my mind. He's someone I think of often. So, yeah.
So in the process of writing your thesis, you got to talk with Branford.
That's right. Yes.
And how was that?
So that was,
and it was interesting. I read someplace that Branford was kind of like not, didn't really. He said, "I don't really know him," you know, in certain regards. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting part of it. I for some reason asked, you know, or he mentioned, yeah, that they weren't. I mean, of course, Branford and Kenya were associated with throughout their careers. You know, playing on each other's records, playing together with Wynton, with Sting, and so I assumed that they were the closest of friends. And I asked Branford, and he said, no, they were. He's like, well, I didn't think I was close with him, and that really caught me off guard. You know, how could they have worked together for so many years and had the, you know, that type of road friendship that musicians have and not be close, you know, and Branford began talking about Rainer Rilke and his writings, and the particular passage of infinite distances exist between the closest of people. And there's something about that really stuck with me and spoke to me, both in terms of kind of explaining a little bit about Kenny, but also for me, just how the way I think of life and relationships and it's something that I thought about for quite a few years, and I often go back to it. So,
had you been writing about that theme? I mean, this is like a six song suite that is kind of the core of the new album. Had you been you know, just composing this kind of stuff as you went along, and finally it kind of felt like, oh, this is a completion? Or did you focus on the theme, the concept, and then write toward that?
I think I was focusing on the concept. There was something about it. I would go back to that. I would go back to that interview and that text of Rilke, and I would read it and I would think about it, and it wouldn't necessarily go right to the piano, but it'd stick with me and I would go back, and I think I tried to. You know, so try to think about that, and I didn't try to think. I couldn't stop thinking about it. But it's basically like, you know, we all want to be close, or we all need other people and have relationships. Very few people are just can survive alone, or maybe nobody can. So, but then there's always something that's our own, I think, that we don't share. There are things that we keep for ourselves, and things that we that no matter how close you get to someone, you they might not know about you. And there's that place that's your own, that's private, is something that I sort of focused on as I was writing, and that feeling that is what inspired the suite. And it was a long process of writing all of it. Some of it was not. I had only written half of it for the first recording session, and so it was a lot of work. I've never written it with that kind of intensity in my life as a composer, and it was good. I feel like it's it pushed me in a different direction as a composer, and the band seemed to pick up on it without us ever having discussed, you know, what it was all about, or that even that it was a suite. That particular material, they really responded to differently, you know. So I think you really hear a difference between the six components of the suite on the record and the other material, which had been written earlier. So
it's really cool. Now, did you write the arrangements for the horns?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
There's amazing arrangements. I love the way they sound together. The soprano and the alto, and then the trumpet. They're just amazing. And the way there's kind of like a flow to them that's like unusual. It's really catchy. The first song, was it Breakdown? Breakdown. No, Subversive. I love Subversive. It's so cool.
Oh, thank you.
And the arrangements on it, it's a great way to start the album. But what did I write? There's a sense of there's a bounce to it. Your piano is really doing overtime as a rhythm instrument, and there's drama and drive to it too. So tell me about Subversive. I'm not going to go through every track on this, but just to select a couple.
And
that's one of my favorites.
Thanks. Yeah. The Subversive is, you know, the Subversive is an interesting piece because it's like it, there's a part of it that's got a kind of a hard bop sort of line to it, you know, and it. And then at the same time, it's got these very abrupt 7/4 vamp and the chords that sound pretty abrasive. That's the introduction. So I like that tension between the two, and I feel like I think the idea behind it is like one thing I sense is everyone wants to categorize you and put you in, you know, you're a straight ahead artist, or you're a modernist, or you're in the avant garde camp, and it's that's what makes things marketable. It's like they fit into it.
Sure.
This is what we talk about. And for me, it's like, no, I don't want to be put in those. I don't want to be categorized like that. I don't want to be, and I don't feel that I actually am in any one camp. And I think it's like a sort of somewhat controversial idea that you can, you know, you can have a record that swings, but also has sort of far out moments and moments that you might hear on an avant-garde record, and then odd meters, and also, you know, some of the rhythmic devices such as cross rhythms and things like that really push the music in a different way, but it can still have that old, that some of that Philly soul to it too. So I think it's a pretty, I think it's a, some, in my mind, it's somewhat subversive. Also, musicians are always saying some type of subversive stuff. If you ever hang around with them, I consider musicians to be just all sort of subversive. You have to be almost a revolutionary just to make your life as a professional musician. You can't be a rule follower, because you would have been talked out of it before you got too far. So yeah.
That's cool. Did you perform that live, or was it different pieces that were kind of put together on that?
For Subversive?
Yeah.
That particular... Yeah, no, it was live. It was live, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Tell me this. You took three tunes from... Which was it? Is it from Momentum or
yes,
Slipstream?
Yes, from Momentum, right,
yeah.
right.
And those were done as a trio.
Yeah, yeah.
And you decided, wow, I've got a sextet going here, why not stretch it out?
Those pieces, I was very honored Positone had wanted to record me in a trio format. I had actually wanted a larger group for that recording and for those tunes, and they really wanted to feature me as a trio, you know, in a piano trio format, and put me out front. And I just played the music that I had been writing and been working on that session, and there was a part of me that felt like, yeah, those tunes. The arrangement hadn't been fully realized, you know, because I had envisioned horns on that, and that wasn't the way that, so I couldn't quite let those go. Like I knew that I wouldn't really be able to sleep until like Momentum had been. I mean, Momentum is an alto sax tune. The alto plays the melody on that, and then the trumpet comes and answers, and there's a call and response, and I couldn't sleep at night until that had been addressed. You know, the tunes are like your children, and you have to you have to treat them right. You know, so yeah, I went back and finished that, and I can move on.
That's cool. Again, that's a rarity too, right? tell me, I've got Juicy, which is one that you were already had done. Tell me about that one, because that's another one of my favorites. There's some kind of a bounce to it, or joy, or something like that, although it's got shadows and stuff, but tell me about Juicy. What can you tell me about Juicy?
Juicy is you know, the idea is that there's these harmonies that are sort of the keys change constantly. Like it's a 7/4 vamp that just cycles through, cycles upward until it finally gets back up to where it started again. So the harmony is quite rich, and that's you know, it's literally, it's just juicy. You can sink your teeth into it, and the type of groove that we created leaves a lot of room for rhythmic interplay and different colors. And yeah, that was an interesting piece that was the only one that featured two horn solos on it, and as well as a piano solo. And we were actually toying with John and Sherelle were going to trade on it, and then it just at the studio, just as we were starting, I was like, you know what? Let's all play solos on it. And I'm glad they all got to stretch out and explore. And you know, everyone had something very different to say on that piece. So that's juicy.
Jeremy takes a real supporting kind of like a horn section role throughout the. Mm-hmm. Because the three horns sound so incredible.
Uh huh. Yeah, you know, so Jeremy's got this big fat sound, and you know, when I think of Jeremy and I have known each other since Cleopatra's Needle jam sessions, since we both were really coming out in the Manhattan scene together, and you know, so when I think of trumpet, I kind of just think of Jeremy, and this record had really been kind of conceived as a two saxophones, but there was a couple things that really just needed trumpet. So Jeremy was he obliged and came in, and I mean the working band had really been John and Sherelle. A lot of times it was just one of them. Actually, it was mostly quartet, but I knew I needed some more horns to fill out the arrangements, and some of it was trumpet. So Jeremy was the go-to guy. He took care of business. Yeah.
He hates me. I did a feature on him in Downbeat, and you know, talking about his new album, and but also the fact that he's like, you know, that he's a side man, you know, incredibly successful, and so I wrote about both of those themes. And he wrote this really incredible note to me and the editor of Downbeat, saying, "You set my career back, you know, to the very beginning by writing this piece." It's totally, you know, I thought we were going to talk about the new album. Well, more than half the piece, the feature, more than half the piece was about your new album.
Was this the one that was pretty recent? Like,
I just started out. I mean, the only opportunity I had to see him was when he was playing as a sideman. And so I like having that kind of, for a feature, I like having that kind of like local color.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I'll start with that theme and then go into this new album. But yeah, he went ballistic. So there you go. Tell me, the only going back to your album, the only cover is the Joe Henderson tune. Tell me about that. Why, Joe? You got all your own compositions there. At the very end, you settle into Serenity.
You know, I mean, that's the other element in terms of that I didn't mention, in terms of bringing back a couple of the old pieces, is that they just, you know, those pieces were brand new when they were first, when I first recorded them, that arrangement and stuff had not really been played much, and it just really evolved on the bandstand. And at a certain, you know, that band that it was with John Davis and Sherelle or John Aravagon, we would close almost every gig with Serenity, and it was hard to record and not play that. I mean, it was just like it had that vamp that we do at the end. I mean, I've announced, and it's just our gigs kind of close on this sort of very thoughtful vibe, and that's the band, that's what we do right now. I wanted to document it, and cool. It was it, yeah. No, that's it, yeah.
Cool.
I also like that I like doing a Joe Henderson tune and having it played on soprano because I thought that was, I mean, it just he happens to bring something really different to the melody to my in my mind with on the soprano. So yeah.
Okay, kind of like the last question. I'm sure I will throw out another question at you, but Collective Native, is that a band that you're in?
Native Soul.
Native Soul.
That's right.
It is a collective, right?
Yes, that's a collective. Yeah, so that was that's been a long-term project, and we're actually in the middle of recording our fourth CD, and that got started actually right even before I moved to New York. My very first gig, the bass player was Marcus McLaurin, the great bass player who played with Dizzy and Clark Terry and Kenny Burrell and everyone. And
so Philadelphia?
It wasn't in Philadelphia. That was actually in Brooklyn. And this is way before I moved to Brooklyn. And so I was actually at Rutgers at the time. And Marcus had this incredible, again, he was a part of that my world at that time. He had this incredible swinging bass playing that is nobody does what he does. And he has his own thing, and it's great. I love playing with him. And so as a certain point, before I started recording my own music or my own CDs, Marcus and I were doing some gigs, and I was like, "Look, we need to do a project together." And he said, "Okay, let's get Steve Johns on drums." And Steve, I had played with a couple times. He wanted to do it, and those guys said, "Okay, let's get Peter Brannon on saxophone," who I didn't know at the time. And yeah, we have a real rapport, and I it's a special group of guys, and they have that soulful thing that I look that does it for me, and we all write music, and yeah, our fourth CD is in the works. So
will that be your fourth or fifth?
That'll be our fourth with that for that band. Yeah.
Do you have any idea when it's going to come out?
Nope.
This probably won't come out for Tuesday. July issue? June-ish? July? I can't remember. So it's out. But I have to file it by Friday. So. But I can just say forthcoming.
Yeah, I'd say, let's say late. Whatever year, 2017, yeah, late 2017, yeah, yeah.
We're good.
Yeah.
Good to go.
Yeah. Great.
750 word piece. But I would love to get John's voice in the mix.
Okay. Yeah.
Just it's like, you know, it ends up being like a 10-minute phone conversation. Is he around?
The Rabagon?
Yeah.
I mean, he's I know we're playing at Birdland soon.
Seventh, right?
Yeah.
The
16th. Yeah. And the 15th and 16th we're playing. But you need him before Friday, right?
I guess.
Okay.
And, you know, I'll call any place. Except Europe is kind of hard to do. That's where Sherelle's is, right?
She's in the Middle East.
Wow, what is she doing there?
She got married.
Nice.
Yeah.
And she's living there?
Yeah, I think it's off the. I think she's
totally
trying to be low key about it. Yeah. I don't think she would be happy with us if we were. Yeah. She got married and is living over there. I mean, she had a steady. There's a steady gig as well for her. But yeah, she's. I think she's planning to come back to New York.
Is she gonna play at your show? No.
Now she can't come back for one or two shows, unfortunately. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we may be able to reach her if Aragon doesn't doesn't come through. Yeah. I guess Pelt is not an option.
What?
I guess Pelt is not an option.
I don't want to talk. You won't want to talk with me.
Yeah. You're not the only one. Hey, trust me.
I thought I wrote a great piece. You know, it's kind of like I felt that I wrote a thoughtful, artistic. I put a form to it and wrote from there. Oh man, this email. It was like,
if you turn these off, I'll tell you a story.
Okay, one last thing.
Oh, yeah.
You use two different rhythm sections, a bass drum. Why? Just because it. The recording dates?
No, it was a conscious decision about what the particular music required. I mean, as I said, I wrote half of this suite after the first session, and I was hearing some different things from the rhythm section to fill out that music. Any of those rhythm sections could play it great, but for the recording, I had a specific thing, and you know, every drummer plays, you know, different beats and different, has such a different approach, and you don't want to sit there and tell someone, oh, do this or do that. You want it not too much. I mean, you want it to be pretty much what they naturally go to. If you have to sit there and talk to them about it too much, then you know, okay, I need to put someone else in there. Yeah, so I just thought about it, and rather than be in that position, I just called the guys that could flesh out what I was hearing in my head.
Cool.
Best. Yeah.
Good enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Stop.